Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the second seminar in the ninth annual series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies. This series of seminars covers all branches of the social studies broadly conceived, from literature to history to sociology to anthropology to economics and political science. This tonight's speaker is Dr. Ruth Farrugia, lecturer in the Faculty of Law, who until recently was a Maltese representative of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR. She has stopped being that, but she continues with her research into refugees and immigrants in Malta. We're very happy to have Ruth back, because last year she also gave a very interesting paper to the Work in Progress seminar series. It was called Asylum Seekers in Transit, the Maltese Experience. May I just say briefly that next week we will also be devoting our time to the whole current debate going on in Malta concerning immigrants and refugees. And next week there will be a symposium. The symposium is titled Refugees and Immigrants, the View from Anthropology. The chairman of the symposium will be Mr. Runyer Fasadni. The speakers will be first myself, Paul Clow, speaking about the African element. The second speaker will be Dr. David Samit, a legal anthropologist, and his talk will be devoted to legal categories and Maltese perceptions of immigrants. The third and final speaker will be Dr. Mark Anthony Falzone, an anthropologist, and his subject will be Immigration and Globalization, Are These Contradictions in Terms? The full program for the seminar series will soon be available. Thank you very much, and I welcome Dr. Ruth Farrugia. This week, she is going to be reading a paper. The topic is From Inmate to Stalemate, the Rejected Asylum Seeker. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. The issue, just so we can place what I'm going to talk about in its perspective, because it's a very, very wide issue, as you'll all appreciate. During recent years, the return of rejected asylum seekers has become an issue of increasing concern within the discourse of migration and protection. After a final rejection in a fair and fully operational asylum procedure, a rejected asylum seeker is expected to return to the country of origin or migrate anywhere else. But in practice, we know that there are a variety of problems that exist, and that's what I'm going to focus on. In a number of cases, the individual doesn't comply voluntarily with an order to leave the state territory. When protection options are insufficient under the national law of the country where asylum is sought, there may be very good reasons for the refusal. But apart from these reasons, there may be other motives less relevant from a protection-oriented perspective. The individual may simply not be prepared to accept that his or her immigration attempt has failed. And faced with a refusal to leave voluntarily, states react by threatening forcible removal, and in a second stage, by actually implementing such a threat. A few definitions, just to get them out of the way. Lawyers love to have definitions straight so that we know what we're talking about. Refugees, as you all know, people who are outside their country of nationality or their usual country of residence and are unable or unwilling to return or to seek protection of that country due to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, in a political, social group or political group. And among others, there can't be war criminals or people who've committed serious non-political crimes. So if you're one of those, you fall under the 1951 refugee definition. The convention, the 1951 Convention on Refugees, doesn't oblige signatory states to provide protection to people who don't fear persecution. and who've left their country of nationality or residence on some other basis, because there's a war, because there's famine, because there's an environmental collapse, whatever. Also, the convention doesn't talk about obligations as to citizenship, for example, for that person who's seeking protection. And that although international law gives these people a right to seek refuge, it doesn't give them a right to choose which country they seek refuge in. And you'll realize straight away that this is extremely topical in Malta, because many people who come to Malta within inverted commas by accident complain that they're here by accident because they had no intention of coming here. They would much rather have gone to Italy. But if Malta is a safe country, then under international law standards, they're safe. They have reached some form of protection. Since the Refugee Act came into force on the 1st of January 2002, the Refugee Commissioner has recognized 83 cases. That's 136 people. That's how many people have been recognized by the Refugee Commissioner as refugees. People granted temporary humanitarian protection, that's the second category we're looking at, are those people who have fled because of a humanitarian disaster or because of a war in their country. The wider protection. And since, again, the 1st of January, when the law came into force, 878 cases, or 1,085 people, were given temporary humanitarian protection. I'll be saying THP from now on because it's a real mouthful to say the whole thing. So 136 refugees, 1,085 THP cases. Most of these cases seem to come from Somalia. The state of civil unrest in Somalia makes it an obvious conclusion that they cannot return to that country at the moment. The third term, the last term, is who is a rejected asylum seeker, because that's who we're going to be talking about. Well, various definitions, but the one I've gone for is, the term is understood to mean people who, after due consideration of their claims to asylum in fair procedures, are found not to qualify for refugee status, nor to be in need of international protection, and who are not authorized to stay in the country concerned. This is a joint UNHCR and IOM, International Organization of Migration, definition. There was an understanding that they reached and they came up with that. The IOM also uses the term unsuccessful asylum seeker, as well as rejected asylum seeker. An unsuccessful asylum seeker may be someone who's actually given up on the asylum process altogether. Once the rejection comes through, there is an obligation on that person to leave the territory and to go back to the state he came from. Ideally, he should leave without the need for any intervention. So a primary consideration in return is to ensure voluntary compliance. What do we mean by voluntary? And what is voluntariness? Well, the IOM gives us a definition, and it says that voluntariness exists when the migrant's free will is expressed, at least through the absence of refusal to return. And by that they mean not resisting boarding transportation, and this is a lovely wide one, not manifesting disagreement. I'll leave that to you to come up with what that means. Anyhow, concerning what this readmission or return means, IOM and UNHCR are in agreement that it should only be considered when the asylum seeker has exhausted all possibilities to be allowed to stay. So you should not ever be sent back while you're still waiting for a result from any procedure, from court, from appeal, from first stage, and this is something that's done in Malta. In the case of non-compliance with the obligation to leave, returning states perceive the need to resort to legal, administrative, and policing measures to secure and enforce compliance. Devising these measures is the second consideration. The third is ensuring the cooperation of the country of origin, and that's a really difficult one, because many countries of origin don't want to comply, don't want the person to come back at all. This could be because involving the issue of travel documents, or in actually accepting the individual to go back. I shouldn't be mentioning countries, so I won't, but I can think of a couple of really obvious examples where there's every problem under the sun for people to be allowed to return from the originating country. The fourth consideration is very often securing the cooperation of third states. If you take Malta as an example, Air Malta flights don't go very far, with all due respect to Air Malta. I mean, there are many routes, but they don't cover the countries that our asylum seekers come from. So we have to use a third country for a transit. And that's also not always easy. As a general rule, people found to have failed definitively in an application for asylum and have no other claim to remain should be expelled. If you don't qualify for asylum, you shouldn't be here. Legally, you shouldn't be here. There may be other humanitarian reasons for which you can be asking to stay. But from a legal basis, you shouldn't be here. Member states need to make legal provisions for expulsion, and we're going to look at what sort of provisions there are available. Normally, the expulsion should be to a country of origin. It could, if you stretch the case, be to the country the person came from. Which is why, for example, Italy has argued that if people reached Italy via Libya, they should be returned to Libya. Now, there's an awful lot to say about that and about safety when you're returning a person. But the basis should be return to the originating country without the need for transit. Now, regarding statistics, all asylum seekers who enter Malta without documentation are detained. That's the policy. All of them are detained on arrival. Since 2002, the majority of arrivals were boat people, and they were all detained. Most of them applied for asylum. As from 1st January 2002 till the end of December 2004, I keep using 1st January 2002 because it's the start of the Refugees Act, there were 3,576 people who arrived. I have a breakdown, but we don't need to go into these. But out of those 3,576, only 2,151 made an application for asylum. Now, there's no official statistics. My very weak mathematics tells me that, therefore, 1,425 people didn't apply. Whether they were immediately repatriated or whether they still languish in one of our detention centres, we don't know. And it's impossible to know without access to the statistics. And the authorities are rather reluctant to give out the statistics. Now, this isn't a purely Maltese problem. There's a recent paper by a German academic who also says, and I quote, "Until now, return has been considered a sensitive issue by politicians and administration. While statistics on asylum applications are readily published and widely dispersed by asylum countries, statistics on return are hard to obtain for most countries. The secrecy surrounding return is considerable, and the question must be asked whether this secrecy augments rather than decreases the political costs of return." And again, another paper by the Centre for Migration at Oxford in 2004 regarding asylum seekers in Europe, she says, "A statistical comparison is extremely difficult, as statistics on deportation are not compiled systematically, are frequently incomplete, and often it is difficult to work out exactly what or who is being counted." So it seems to be quite a common process across the board. She comes up with a few interesting statistics. For 2003, Germany sent back 24,000 people. France, in 10 months of 2003, nearly 29,000 people. And Italy, for 2002, using Caritas statistics, 45,245 people. That's a lot of people. There are conflicting statistics here, even about how many people are in detention. I mean, the Commissioner of Police, on the 7th of February, at the national conference held, said that there were 532 detainees and 674 people in open centres. The Honourable Minister for the Interior, replying to a parliamentary question on the 31st of January of this year, said there were 620 people in detention. I find it hard to believe that in the space of 1 week, 100 people were released. So there's something funny with the statistics. However, the focus of the paper is not to dwell on detention, but it's impossible not to talk about the effect that lengthy detention will have on anyone, but in particular on someone who will be released with no future except repatriation. And I think we really have to keep this in mind. excuse me. What I would have liked to do was compare asylum processes. Failing my overhead, you're just going to have to listen to me for a couple of minutes and try and use your imagination. I wanted to compare the English process, which is where we got our ideas from, and the Maltese process. So basically, on arrival, an application is made. Actually, sorry, I'll backtrack one. On arrival, a preliminary questionnaire is handed out, a PQ. And this questionnaire asks for basically bio details, who you are, where you're from, what nationality you are, how old you are, who your mother is, who your father is, whether they're alive, whether you have any brothers or sisters, where they are, stuff like that. Basic information. It's in English. It is handed out in a detention center to people, many people, who cannot read the application they're given. It has to be filled in, and it has to be filled in correctly, because if you enter items which are untrue, this may be taken to mean that you are not credible. And when you're interviewed, this will be held against you. A large number, and I know that's vague, but I really mean a large number of asylum seekers, are helped by fellow asylum seekers. One person among a big group who can cope with English, and who therefore translates into his language, or sometimes even secondhand, into another language. You know, you have him translating, and then someone else translating again. But still, this PQ is this important. It's not administered by an immigration official. That's a big problem. Anyhow, the English process says that an immigration officer must do this, or an asylum caseworker. The actual asylum interview takes place before the refugee commissioner, and that's a very different ballgame. The rules there are very strictly adhered to. The refugee commissioner asks a lot of questions, very interesting questions, tries to reach the grounds on which the asylum seeker is stating his claim, why that person should be entitled to asylum or not. The refugee commissioner, as you probably know, has a 57% success rate. 57% of all people who apply for asylum in Malta get some form of asylum. Refugees, as you saw, in the minority, the rest gets THP, temporary humanitarian protection. But that still leaves 43% of all these people who get nothing, who are told that their case doesn't qualify for any form of protection. Those people have the right to appeal. They are given a form by the refugee commissioner saying that their case has been rejected, and they have the right to appeal, and the time for appeal is 15 days. Now, a large number of people cannot understand the form and don't really realize how important this is, and don't appreciate that 15 days really means 15 days. If you don't apply within 15 days, your appeal isn't going to be heard. And I meet people constantly who try to explain why they haven't appealed in time. This morning, for example, I met a lady with a newborn baby who was in detention till the baby was born and assured me, swore 100%, that she never received this rejection certificate. This was in December. And I'm trying to say, well, you know, since December, but we're talking 2 months, not 2 weeks. What grounds are you going to give for appealing? Because as soon as the appeal board sees the date, they simply say, this is over the limit, I won't consider it. I'm talking about this in the context of giving the rejected asylum seeker every opportunity to make the claim correctly, because I've said more than once, it has to be a fair procedure. It could be that during the appeal procedure, the asylum seeker has the right to free legal aid. That's in the law. However, the appeals board has publicly lamented about the lack of free legal aid available. And there are, if I'm not mistaken, 483 cases still pending because of the lack of legal aid. So these are people, many of whom are in detention, because their appeal cannot be heard, because they don't have a lawyer to assist them in the process. A lawyer they have asked for, that they are entitled to. The English system has more than one appeal. We have the PQ, which is an initial part of the process, the first interview, the appeal, if there's the need for an appeal, and that's it. You can go to the Constitutional Court if you need to do that, but more often than not, the appeal stage is where it comes to an end. If you receive additional information after the appeal, can you reopen an appeal? Well, the law doesn't say you can, but it would be fair if you had additional information. It's very difficult to come up with information from a lot of these countries. Facts after facts, there's no phone lines, it's very difficult to get information, sometimes to prove a negative. And in those cases, I think people should definitely be given another chance. I have a little quote about the release at 18 months, which you definitely cannot see. It's taken from the JRS policy recommendations made last week. They interviewed a variety of people. And one gentleman said this: "So now, how can I be myself? How can I get my independence? Without money from the government, no work permit, no travel document, what should I do? I have to stay here, but I cannot work, so how should I live? Should I steal? Should I corrupt, hijack, do bad things? No. But if these things happen, who would be to blame? I want to be able to live, to have a future. To live as a human being, but like this, I cannot. Because the rejected asylum seeker comes out of detention at the 18-month cut-off period with absolutely no rights at all. Just as he said, no right to work, no right to a travel document, no right to medical services, no right to accommodation legally, even though it's given. And therefore, these people are really with their backs against the wall. I keep referring to the 18-month rule, so perhaps just a few words about this. Until December 2003, the duration of detention was indefinite, and it lasted until some status was accorded or repatriation took place. In practice, for example, a number of Sudanese who arrived in Malta in November 2001 were released after 28 months. They were released in April 2004. Most of the KK group who arrived in October 2002 waited till June 2004 to be released, 20 months. The KK group, the groups are given an initial. So they started with A, went to Z, then AA to ZZ, triple A, and we're in the triple letters at the moment. No distinction was made between men, women, children, and family units. Large numbers of families with children were kept in detention up to 22 months. And there's one particular case of a minor with his sister. They were detained from January 2003 till June 2004. France detains for 32 days maximum, Italy for 60 days maximum in exceptional cases, and Germany the strictest for 6 months maximum. In December 2003, the government started a discretionary policy of releasing persons who had been in detention for more than 18 months. There was no legislation and no policy about this. Last week, however, in the policy document, it's black on white. It says, no immigrant shall be held in detention for longer than 18 months. However, my reading, I may be wrong, seems to be that 18 months is a reasonable period of detention. I mean, otherwise they could have said, will not be detained longer than administratively necessary. Why mention an 18-month period? But that might be my speculation. Anyway,
I have this lovely transparency.
I don't know if you can see this. I have a son who's a chess buff, so the chess idea really interested me. Anyhow, before we get on to the rejection, or rather in the rejection context, I thought I should look at what rights are given to rejected asylum seekers in the international arena. So what the Council of Europe says and what the European Union says. We're members of both. We should adopt what both of them tell us to do. Council of Europe have done a lot of work about rejected asylum seekers. They're very clear as to the rights of rejected asylum seekers to an effective remedy against decisions on expulsion. And basically what they use, because there's no asylum instrument, is the European Convention on Human Rights. It's all human rights based. There is a specific committee of experts called CEHA. Well, it's a committee of experts on the legal aspects of territorial asylum, refugees and stateless persons. The acronym is CAHAR, known as CEHA. These are people who give an opinion, give advice to the Committee of Ministers regarding issues on asylum. And they were asked on several occasions to come up with what they thought would be the fairest thing to do regarding repatriation or return of rejected asylum seekers. The last opinion given was at the end of 2002. And they said that in order to implement a recommendation made in 1998 regarding return, what was needed was an effective remedy for rejected asylum seekers against the decision on expulsion. You're wonderful. And they also proposed the setting up of a working group on a code of good conduct. What constitutes the acceptable way, the proper way of sending someone back, if you have to send them back at all. There needs definitely to be... Great, thank you. Don't know how sharp this is. The others were a real stalemate, and I have just one to go. Chess pieces, anyway. That's as regards the Council of Europe. The EU also... Well, the problem with the EU, the basic problem, is that there's no common union determination regarding which countries are impossible to return rejected asylum seekers to, for example. It's left to the discretion of each member state. There was a green paper written out on community return policy on illegal residents. And this was issued by the European Commission in 2002. A decision was taken about it at the end of 2002, at the end of November, and an action plan was made regarding what work would be carried out to facilitate return of rejected asylum seekers. There have also been a couple of questions to the Commission specifically about rejected asylum seekers. I've lifted a couple of them, which I think are very interesting. For example, I'll just quote one for time. At the end of December, the reply was, at this stage, every member state applies its own criteria when a government makes such a determination. The Commission has suggested in its recent communication on a community return policy on illegal residents that an assessment mechanism should be established, which would provide for assessment of actual situation of certain countries as to whether removals are feasible or not. According to case law of the European Court on Human Rights, the fact that return of failed asylum seekers is impossible does not impose an obligation to grant a residence permit. And therefore the union will not interfere. Now that's real bad news. Does not impose an obligation. What we're waiting for is this future directive on minimum standards for return, but that still doesn't solve the issue of people who are left behind who cannot return. What they did come up with in the action plan is to list four main points, and they say there should be better practices, including an exchange of information and best practices and training for immigration officials. There should be common minimum standards for return. And we'll see in a minute what I'm talking about, where return goes horribly, horribly wrong. Country-specific programs and intensified cooperation with third countries regarding return. Now, I've chosen a few countries that Maltese asylum seekers like to go to. That's the criteria I've used. Terribly unscientific, but it would have been no use for me to talk about Spain or Portugal, for example, because Maltese asylum seekers who want to move on don't go to Spain and Portugal. They like going to the Scandinavian countries, all the Scandinavian countries. Norway, and I mention Norway because it's non-EU, which causes another problem. Switzerland, Belgium sometimes, and Germany. They're the popular places. Italy, to some extent, but as a stepping stone to somewhere else. Now, there's no time to go into all of them, but just some of them, just so that you get a taste of what sort of procedures they apply. You probably all know that Eurodac is here to stay. It's a fingerprinting process. Every asylum seeker who comes to Malta is fingerprinted. And the fingerprints are communicated with all the rest of the union. So if you go, Norway included, because they're in on this, if you go to Norway and you've asked for asylum in Malta and you apply for asylum when you get to Norway, Norway will look you up, find your prints and say, you've applied in Malta, and they send you straight back. You may somehow manage to get in without being checked, but they will pick you up at some point in time. And we've had people who return after 3 months, 4 months. They eventually track you down. Eurodac is working fine from the policing point of view. Belgium, for example, on paper says that it fosters independent return, voluntary return, and migration and development, and provides cash, money, to try to help you go back home. It gives you extra social benefits to encourage you to leave and to set up shop when you eventually get back to your country. Denmark, for example, says that it gives every possible help to you to be able to make your asylum application at all stages. And unless there is a manifestly unfounded case, then you definitely will not be returned. As a matter of fact, they say that they can also grant a temporary residence permit on humanitarian grounds if you've received a rejection. However, then I looked up the Danish Refugee Council, and they say that in fact it's next to never that this sort of permit is actually awarded. So it's there on paper, but it doesn't really happen. The Netherlands is another popular country that people like to go to, and they're under a lot of fire at the moment. The number of rejected asylum seekers leaving the Netherlands has hit record highs this year. This is a newspaper cutting, with 2011 having already departed, compared with 2,912 for the entire 12 months of 2003. Sorry, this was August. So 2011 till August, as compared to 3,000 for the whole year. They're also being given special funding, and there is a deportation scheme to encourage people to go back voluntarily. For example, every asylum seeker, besides the airfare and possible compensation for shipping of household goods, remember these people are not put into detention, receive €2,320. If it's a family with two children, we're talking about just over €6,000 to help you go back home and resettle. Switzerland is a completely different ball game. The Swiss have decided that they're going to get tougher regarding sending people back. I don't know if you can see, there's our good friend Hilly Robles with, thank you, whoops. The Human Rights Commissioner with the Swiss Interior Minister. He went and paid a visit to Switzerland, a five-day visit to Switzerland, and was asked a series of questions regarding detention conditions and prison conditions, but detention conditions, because of this new legislation that Switzerland is proposing. For example, on the last year, in April of last year, the Swiss government decided to stop welfare payments for all rejected asylum seekers. So once you're rejected, you're on your own. Basically, same situation here, only in Switzerland it used to be better. And what they're proposing is that police should be allowed to use electroshock weapons and shackles to restrain foreigners who resist forced deportation. So it's acknowledged that you might need to, let's say, encourage someone to leave the country if they don't want to, but they're taking it a little step further. Actually, what they're saying is there's going to be limits on what you can use. Unfortunately, though, what you can use includes truncheons and electroshock treatment. And Hill Robles says, I'm very concerned. Of course, on occasion, people need to use restraints because sometimes people can be violent. Police officers who have a difficult and unpleasant job have to be protected, but you need limits. Someone whose hands and legs have been tied and who's being held down by three people does not also need to be beaten with a truncheon or stunned by an electric shock weapon. This was a picture of the protest that was carried out by human rights groups at the end of November. The legislation will be discussed sometime this year, probably before Easter. So we're talking about in a few weeks or a couple of months' time, whether this will go through. And then it'll be presented to Parliament. Probably one of the nicest places to go to, one of the most honest places to go to that deals with asylum seekers is Norway. But as I say, Norway checks up on Eurodac, and if you don't qualify, they send you straight back home. Also, Finland, and the last country, Germany. Germany learnt a lot through a terrible tragedy that happened quite a few years ago, which you may remember because it was really publicized in the press. They were using commercial flights to return rejected asylum seekers. And because people who didn't want to go home made a big fuss on a commercial flight, the means of restraint they used were sometimes over the top. Well, one particular gentleman from Sudan was on a plane being forcibly repatriated with a guard either side of him, wearing a helmet for his protection because he was thrashing about on the plane. He was held down and he suffocated. And this is just one case. There have been numerous cases of returned asylum seekers who have died on their way home. What Lufthansa did was refuse, point blank, to take any more people home on commercial flights. This was their reaction. And Amnesty, for example, issued a statement saying, thank goodness they've done it, because of this stand, several other people have benefited from it. For example, there's one particular documented case of a man who said that a Congolese citizen, a 31-year-old, who says he was beaten up by border police after he resisted deportation on a Lufthansa flight. Excuse me, he had been jailed in Congo for political reasons and escaped when another inmate of his, a friend, was shot. Because he refused to get on the flight And because Lufthansa refused to take him on unless it was voluntarily, he managed to stop going back to Congo. After a period of time, the information he needed to prove his case came through, and he was granted asylum. So that's one of the cases. Okay, now, where I'd like us to end up. Chess theme again. There has been research on ways of encouraging the return, mainly Finland and the Netherlands. They've done projects, usually in conjunction with the IOM, to see whether people, if positively encouraged to return, would actually take up the offer. And they found that they will. If people are given the chance to start afresh in their home country, these are rejected asylum seekers. In no way am I ever referring to people who qualify for protection. Then they will actually take up the offer and they will go back home. France has been doing this for a very long time. As a matter of fact, what they're doing at the moment is carrying out a survey to see whether the rejected asylum seekers who have been returned and given money to set up a business or whatever in their own home country are in fact returning to France later on down the line. Because believe it or not, they haven't kept statistics on this. Anyhow, what are the conditions for return, if return's going to happen? Well, first of all, the country of origin has to be interested in taking them back, and that's a big problem. But then, a rejected asylum seeker can't be, or shouldn't be, compelled to return. They have to be able to know that they're going to be safe when they go back home. In the eyes of UNHCR, for example, safe means that there must be legal safety. So if you're going back home, you know that you're not going to end up in prison. You know that there's an amnesty for whatever reason you left. You know that you're not going to be persecuted when you get back. Physical safety, you're not going to be under armed attack, or there's no landmines waiting for you in the locality you're going back to. Material safety, you must have a means of livelihood, otherwise you wouldn't go back, would you? All these conditions. You should be able to return with dignity. That's the second one. Safety, dignity. So this means that when you're repatriated, there should be no violence. There should be no conditions, because it's your right to return. You should be allowed enough time to make up your mind. You shouldn't be separated from your family. A variety of reasons. And then lastly, humanitarian conditions. For example, a family should not be separated. It might sound obvious, but families are separated on return. If there's someone receiving medical treatment and it can't be interrupted, that person should not be returned. If we're talking about pregnant women from the 28th week till 3 months after delivery, they should not be returned. There are various people who fall under this category. The voluntary compliance, therefore, needs three people, basically. It needs the returning state, the country of origin, and the person, him or herself. Where the migration policies offer legal options, then the illegal alternatives, which are what is used now, don't hold much attraction anymore. Voluntary compliance would be enhanced if there were legal frameworks. We don't have a legal framework for return. These guidelines would be very useful in bringing national practice into line with international legal obligations. Also, I think it would be a good idea to see that the way the return process, if it happens, is carried out, is monitored, possibly by an international organization or more than one international organization, and by NGOs, who have every interest to see that the asylum seeker receives all the rights that are due to him. I think the transparency which you would attain by this monitoring would benefit states. It would legitimate the practices, and individuals would put greater trust in the state practice. And then lastly, I think returning states should refrain from any measures which could possibly violate human rights. Countries of origin should also do what they can to not violate human rights. Unless there's a decent, adequate return policy, an offer, on incentive, for people to be able to go home, we will end up with what we have now, with numbers of people who are released on 18 months with no rights whatsoever and with no hope whatsoever, because much as they wish to leave, they have no travel document. So if they want to leave, they must leave illegally. No right to work, so if they work to support themselves and their family, they must work illegally. And apart from the general unfairness and immorality of the situation, I think it pushes people to do things that they really don't want to do. And asylum seekers, rejected or not, have invariably been through enough without having to confront another terrible choice as to whether they can live in a society that doesn't want them and makes it very clear by not giving them their rights, or by helping them retain some form of dignity and giving them the opportunity to go back. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ruth, for an extremely informative paper. The floor is now open for questions, discussion.
My name is Rafa Basallo from Independence. I want to ask, you mentioned, and I took down the statistics but I can't place them, the number of people who applied for refugee status and were granted, as opposed to the number of people who were not granted. I believe it was 47% or 43%. What happens to those people who do not apply for refugee status at all? I know it's outside the actual scope of your talk.
I think it's a very valid question. And I made the point right at the beginning. I was trying to say that the people who actually applied for asylum were 3,576. But only 2,151 made an application, which means we have a shortfall of 1,425 people. And because I don't know, even though I've asked, I don't know what's happened to those 1,425 people, you can assume that they've either gone back home, forcibly or voluntarily, or they're in detention. People do ask to go back. People do come here and realize that there's no hope of their application being granted and ask for repatriation. I've met quite a few people. Then there are people who are automatically returned. The whole aim of what I've been trying to say is that if there is a return policy, it should be a clear policy, and that people should know what their chances are at the outset. Otherwise, we'll end up with a situation like they had in Lampedusa in October, where you had over 300 people automatically returned to Libya simply because the Italian government decided they weren't welcome in Italy.
I'm Antoine Vella. I'm a lecturer at the Institute of Agriculture. I was under the impression that all those who were rejected were immediately repatriated, because the idea was that if asylum hasn't been granted, it means that they are not in danger or in any danger of being persecuted. So even the condition that of safety that you mentioned doesn't apply, because if there is any danger, they would be granted asylum, theoretically. Otherwise, I mean, the authorities have satisfied themselves that the person is not in danger, otherwise they would grant asylum, no? So I don't understand this condition. This is somebody leaving Egypt to get a better job, and therefore does not qualify for refugee status, and then being sent back to Egypt, for example. Then we have, from not just from Somalia, but from North Africa as well, several who ask for asylum.
Yeah, you're right. If you come to Malta purely for economic reasons, you're an economic refugee. That's a complete contradiction in terms, and it's so unlegal. I mean, it's so incorrect. If you come for economic purposes, you're an economic migrant. That's the correct term. But you try to be a refugee. You're saying that you just cannot survive without coming to another country. You don't fall under the 1951 convention. So it's as simple as that. You do fall under wider definitions of refugee status, but they're not recognized by the Refugee Commissioner. But there are people who aren't as clear-cut cases as simply being economic or non-economic. I'll give you an example. People who came here from Iraq during the time of Saddam Hussein, okay, and who got refugee status because they fled persecution. Well, Saddam Hussein is no longer there. So, logically, the reason for which they were given refugee status no longer applies. They can go back home. However, Iraq at the moment is not exactly, from what I see on the news, because I haven't been there, a very comfortable place to live in. And therefore, many people who are here are saying, listen, it's not a safe place for me to go back to. So I think a lot of other conditions need to come in. But the first point you made, if I can go back to that one, is your assumption that immediately on rejection, people will be sent back home. I think most people assume that. If you don't qualify, what are you doing here? The police say, and I'm sure that it's very true, that with many countries, it's very difficult to repatriate. The country just won't cooperate. It won't acknowledge the person as being a citizen of that country. It won't identify them as having ever lived there. The person might be giving false information. They might say they come from one country, and that country will look them up and say, no one of that name or date of birth has ever existed here. I'm not taking him back. Why should I be responsible? So it's not always easy to repatriate. But we're talking about big numbers of repatriation, and we're talking about the costs. It costs a lot of money to repatriate people. But I argue that it costs a lot more not to repatriate people. And probably that's why so many of these countries are now taking on this new return policy of providing incentives for people to go back home. I'm sure that if the authorities could repatriate everyone who was rejected, they would do so. What we have at the moment is a situation where, in detention, we have people who have applied for asylum in the first instance, people who are awaiting an appeal decision, and people who have been rejected are all in detention together. And that's a really bad situation. I mean, you can imagine, they're completely different issues. They're in a very different situation, but they're all together.
Ruth, your paper raises so many questions and so many issues and, of course, so many requests for factual material. Just one small question before I pass the microphone to another speaker. The 43% who have been rejected, do we know what their status is now in Malta? Are they still in detention?
Okay. The 43% have appealed. Most of the 43% have appealed. The appeal board has given one positive decision, one case. One case with, I think it's two or three people. When we say a case, it's a family, okay? So it could be a single person or it could be more. It's one family. The rest of the people have been confirmed as rejected. And they remain in detention until 18 months or repatriation. Logically, you should remain in detention forever and ever if you have no status, because from the legal aspect, why should you be out of detention if you have no status at all? If you have no rights, how can you support yourself out of detention? But the government has agreed that 18 months is far too long to be kept in detention for something that is not a crime, because remember, it's not illegal, it's irregular immigration, and therefore you come out. It is a real problem.
Adrian. Yeah, Adrian Grima. I'd like to know what happens to people who have been granted humanitarian status. who are here in Malta, and the refugee commission or the immigration officials tell them that now they can return because their country is now safe. I have a good friend of mine is in this situation, that he's been here for some time. He works legally. Of course, he pays tax and all that. Mm-hmm. But now the immigration officials and even the refugee commission are telling him that he can go back to his country when any newspaper of any worth will tell you that the area he comes from is in turmoil, is getting worse than it was when he actually left. So, sort of, is there some kind of legally binding information that he can somehow latch onto to make his case, or how does it happen after your humanitarian status is somehow revoked? Does he become sort of a rejected asylum seeker then?
Okay, interesting point. It's called THP because it is temporary. It's temporary humanitarian protection. Mind you, refugee status is temporary. You're not a refugee forever. If the conditions change, if you don't need protection anymore, you can go back. That's where the idea is coming from. So if you have temporary humanitarian protection, the idea is that one day it will be safe to return. Now, who decides whether it's safe to return? That's your question. UNHCR publishes official recommendations. That's what they are. They're recommendations as to safety or the lack of safety. It will say, at the moment, I recommend that no one be returned to Darfur. So all refugee commissioners throughout the world will say, UNHCR said Darfur is not safe. I'm bound by it. I give anyone who says and who can prove, that's another thing, that they are from Darfur or that they need to return to Darfur, I must give them temporary humanitarian protection automatically. Like the example I gave right at the beginning of people from Somalia. If you can prove you're from Somalia, you're going to get THP straight away. There are countries, however, that UNHCR will go into and say, listen, the situation's not as bad as they're making out. There may be sporadic fighting, but in fact, it is safe to return. And therefore, they will issue another statement after a great deal of thought and say, the country's safe, so you don't need to give THP anymore. In which case, the refugee commissioner will say, well, that's it then. I'm going to take my protection from all those people, not only people coming in, new people, but also the old ones. If they've got a certificate, the certificate's done year by year. I don't know if you've... there's a certificate issued by the refugee commissioner, which gives you usually a year's time of protection. Once the year runs out, you've got to go back. Now, you should be going back voluntarily because it's safe to return. But a lot of people... people who've been here for years, people who have a job here, people who have integrated into society, people who have children who go to Maltese school, who speak Maltese, they feel very strongly that they shouldn't be forced to return because they've integrated. We do have, this is outside this, but we do have the right to sit, no, not the right, sorry, we do have the option to apply for citizenship after you've been here for 5 years. So far, no refugee has ever been given citizenship. But at law, after 5 years, you can apply for citizenship. So the gentleman you're mentioning, if he, it's ridiculous to say this, but I mean, with THP, all he can do is probably go through the websites and try and find out reasons why he shouldn't return, reasons why he personally would be in danger. Otherwise, the option would be him having to go home. One interesting thing that a lot of people with THP don't realize is that they have been rejected. The refugee commissioner issues a statement saying, you have been rejected as a refugee, because the application was for refugee status, but because of the circumstances of your country, you are given temporary humanitarian protection. You can appeal from that. Just because you've got temporary humanitarian protection doesn't mean you can't appeal. And many people don't realize that temporary humanitarian protection still gives them the chance to appeal. Because even though people with temporary humanitarian protection have many rights, they have the right to find a job, not a work permit, a permit to work. Anyway, they have the right to find a job, they have the right to medical assistance, they have the right to free education. They don't have the right, for example, to family reunification. They can't bring their family here. A refugee can, but if you've got THP, you don't. And many of them only realize when they try to bring their wife here. They haven't seen their wife in years. Now they're safe. Why shouldn't she come here? Well, with THP, you can't bring her in. It's a very interesting issue. Thank you.
My name is Bedirzina. I'm one of the refugees here in Malta. I've been here for the last 15 years. And there's actually 2 points which I'm going to mention. The first of all about the THP, the people who they have got temporary humanitarian protection. Unfortunately, these people, they don't have sort of like a lawyer who can advise them what their rights and what that they can do, or even since when they touch the land here, what they can do or what they have to do. So even about the mentioned about the paper which they're being given to fill up, so they don't have anybody to help them up, to give it the right and to explain to them how they should behave or how they should give their details correctly and even for their good. The second, I might come with the same point as the first Adrian have talked about this person who have been as a THP. But what about the refugees, especially who have been here for the long time? And the problem is that their country, there is no hope that they might get back to, especially when, for example, take a situation like in Palestine. The Israeli, they are saying that no Palestinian refugee will get back, and the Palestinians, they are asking for their refugees to get back. So situation like this, and especially the people who they've been for a long time, and they don't have, for example, I'll give an example, like 15 years here in Malta, it's not something, it's particularly half of my life. And I know some people who they are in the same situation as this. And I know people who they applied for citizenship, and you have right to apply and have right to refuse or to keep you on or to keep you hang, whatever you can call it. So what the thing you can do about it? I mean, everyone around the globe, especially in such countries like in England or Norway or Sweden, they give them the right to settlement so they can start their life. Imagine a person who after a long period of time, just in a second, just say, listen, you'll go back. So can you imagine about a situation like this? What a person can do in this case?
Yeah. Thank you for your points. I think of all the people, I mean, here, certainly, you're the person who's upfront with this in the most real way, because you've experienced this. The issue of return when things become better is a big issue, not only Europe, in any country where there are refugees. The statement that you've made, listen, you've been here 15 years, it's half your life. I mean, you're used to being here. Why should you have to go anywhere else? There have been court cases instituted on this basis. In Malta, it's a discretionary power to grant citizenship. And as I said, to date, no single refugee has yet been given citizenship. I wait for the day. One of the recommendations that I made on behalf of an NGO I work for is that all refugees in particular, but I think also temporary humanitarian protected people, should be given a residence permit so that there is an official means of knowing exactly when you arrived and what sort of rights you were given from the date of your residence. Which is something that's done in Norway, as you mentioned, in quite a number of other European countries. And with residency come other rights. For example, refugees, as you probably know, even though they have loads of rights, don't have all the rights. as citizens. Refugees can't be self-employed, can't employ other people, can't buy a house on terms that Maltese people can, because they're considered third country nationals, and therefore Acquisition of a Movable Property Act applies to them, AIP, and if you're going to buy a flat, it can't be less than 30,000, and if it's a house, it can't be less than 50. So there's lots of discrimination still against refugees, let alone against people under temporary humanitarian protection who have even less. So, of course, there's loads still to be done in this regard. The first question, would you remind me the first thing that you mentioned, because you talked about something completely different?
The first one was about the people who just touched the land, the people who just arrived.
That's right, the lack of assistance, thank you, because it's such an important point. Again, another recommendation is that as soon as you arrive, you're automatically assigned to someone. Be it a social worker, I don't know, call it what you will, someone who has responsibility for you to make sure that you understand what's going on. That's the first basic thing. Anyone who works with asylum seekers knows that the communication problem is one of the biggest problems. My language skills are extremely limited. I can't speak Tigrinya. All the different dialects and languages people speak from all over Africa, it's amazing, the wonderful wealth of language. And I can't make myself understood most of the time. So for them to fill in something as important as this PQ, as you so rightly say, when they don't really understand what it says, and even worse, they don't understand how important it is and what the consequences are, that's wrong. And the recommendation is that there should be assistance to these people when they're filling in these things. Also, that they should be updated as to what's happening. They should know that this is how the process works. Listen, you fill in the PQ, and then you go for health screening, and then they see whether you prima facie qualify or not, and if you do, well, then you don't have to stay in detention. Let's give you an identity card. And on that identity card, let's say that you have the right to work. You have the right to medical assistance. And if you have children, they have the right to go to school. What happens at the moment is that on release, people come out of detention, rush to, don't have any money for the bus, so they borrow money, because the allowance that's given is handed out through the Emigrants Commission, which is in Valletta. So if you're in a detention center, you've got to get there somehow. Then they go to the police for an identity card, which takes time. Then they apply for a work permit, which takes about 4 weeks, which you have to pay for. It costs money. And if you have THP, every time you change your job, you have to pay again. An extra tenner, which might not sound like a lot to you, but most people with THP do casual work, so it's very easy to spend £80 in a year on renewals. So what happens? People don't renew. If you don't renew, you're working illegally. If there's an accident, and there have been quite a few bad accidents, you don't get any compensation. You go for your health screening, for your x-rays, after you're released. You somehow have to find where Orme Polyclinic is. I mean, it really gets you. People from, you know, who've never been to Malta, who've been in detention since they arrived, have to find Orme Polyclinic and go for health screening. So, again, a proposal is that all this is done before you leave detention, during the short period. And after that short period, you come out ready to integrate or move on. It's up to you, but you should be given both options.
Ruth, by focusing on rejected asylum seekers, you've really rather extended the discussion and the debate and some of the thinking which is going on in Malta today, because you're giving us some information to suggest that there are countries in Europe where when people seeking asylum are offered the financial incentives to return, they do take up that offer. This is a different way of looking at things. Essentially, in the debate going on in Malta over the last year, certainly over the last month, assumes that the problem is when they come, either Malta can't get rid of them or they must move forward to the new destination. Now you are saying that many would take up that option. Do we have at the moment a bit more research from, you mentioned Finland and Holland as being two countries where research has been done. If people are given encouragement to return, and you're speaking specifically of rejected asylum seekers,
yes,
then many do take up the offer.
They're the two latest. As I say, France has been doing it for a very long time. For example, in the Netherlands, there's no registration of voluntary leave, which means there's no indication of the number of rejected asylum seekers that leave the Netherlands as a result of return migration policy. So experts assume that the choice to return to the home country depended for a major part on the perception of the asylum seeker of the safety situation in the home country. So if they know what... there's also another factor. Many rejected asylum seekers would have left home a long time ago. I mean, they haven't caught a flight and come to Malta. It's taken them months. Sometimes it's taken them years to get here. So if they're reassured regarding what's going on in their home country, that's one very important issue. Secondly, the level of integration. If the person has integrated, then he's not going to want to go back. If he's settled, if he's happy, if his family's happy, why go back? If he hasn't been here long enough to integrate, then he may very well consider it. And thirdly, the perception of the asylum seeker regarding his future. Will he think that Malta, I'm using Malta, this is about the Netherlands, will he think Malta's a good place to stay? Does he think there's a future for him? Many asylum seekers don't think there's a future for them. Rejected asylum seekers in particular know there's no future because they have no rights to do anything at all. And they're extremely annoyed about the fact that they can't go anywhere because they don't have a travel document. No status, no travel document. So they're really stuck here. I honestly think that with rejected asylum seekers, if the option were for them to go backwards, they might very well take it up. I don't know. Until we do it, we won't know. But certainly, where we are at the moment needs rethinking. So this is one suggestion.
On directly from the last one, when you talk about financial incentives, what exactly are we talking about? How does it work? I mean, where does the finance come from, and what are these people being offered upon return?
Well, Netherlands and Finland have invested quite a lot of money, and I mentioned to you, I think it was 6,000 euros for a family of two and two children, for example, from the Netherlands. That comes from the government of the Netherlands. The IOM, the International Organization of Migration, has helped in a very big way. Basically, to resettle people. For example, if I'm going to encourage anyone to go back, I don't know, to the Congo, I would try to make sure that when that person goes back, he would find a job. And he would have enough money to be able to live with his family decently for, say, 6 months till he gets on his feet. So we are talking about a financial outlay, yes. Having said that, with this new EU directive that's still very much in the think stage, possibly one could encourage the EU to invest some money in this. If the EU is so unhappy about illegal immigration, about immigration at all, and wants rejected asylum seekers to go back, then maybe they can put some money into it.
If you don't mind, one other question. Recently in the local media, there was a report about a directive from the European Union encouraging all member states to integrate as quickly as possible. I'm not sure exactly what was meant to be integrated, this is coming to the question, into the labour market, into the workforce. Do you know about this directive and how it would work if applied, and why
is it applied? That's about asylum. That's That's the people who are accepted.
I see. So it doesn't extend to
well, if you the whole principle, as has been pointed out, if you're rejected, you shouldn't be here. If you've been accepted, then you should be integrated. And all efforts should be made to help you integrate, if you want to integrate. Because that's another problem. Many people who... It takes three to integrate. It takes the receiving country, the people of the receiving country, it takes the authorities, and it takes the person. If the person doesn't want to integrate, if the person refuses to learn English, is French speaking, and will make absolutely no effort to communicate, how can that person ever integrate? And we do have people like that who live in Malta. So integration depends, but if you're not, if you have no status at all, then legally you shouldn't be thinking about integrating. And the problem arises when you do integrate, even though you have no status. Because then the law is caught in this double bind of saying, well, you shouldn't be here, but you are. You fit in really well, but you shouldn't have. What am I going to do with you? Yeah.
Sorry, it's one last question.
Save him going backwards and forwards.
It regards the 1951 Convention, which I have to confess I haven't read. What I wanted to ask is, from what I understood from your talk, it seems not to cover the eventuality of war in a country. So fleeing from a country in which there is a war, the way I've understood it, if you are not personally being persecuted for various reasons, that does not entitle you, from what I've understood, to refugee status. If you had applying that to rather well-known humanitarian crises internationally over the last few years, and the one that immediately sprung to my mind was the one in Afghanistan, immediately after the bombing, when neighbouring countries were flooded with thousands of refugees. How can that possibly apply in the sense that what can be done with these people if they're not they can't apply for refugee status? How is it possible that those will not be considered the conditions for...
But they can apply, and they do apply. And then what they're given is humanitarian protection. And there are various categories of protection. For example, you could be declared to be a person of concern. I haven't got into all of them, obviously. You could be declared to be a person of concern to UNHCR, for example, or to the Commission. You could be... You need not even have left the country. You could be an internally displaced person. And as an IDP, you still qualify for protection. So there are various grades of protection that you would get, but the 51 Convention focuses on you personally being the subject of persecution, fear, the whole. But it has to be a personal issue. But that doesn't exclude other forms of protection. Added to the 51 Convention, one would have to look at all the ExCom decisions. The UNHCR has a body which still produces, not exactly legislation, but recommendations that are taken on very seriously. And there's a big body of case law and soft law which also influences interpretation. But if you look, for example, at the definition of refugee that JRS, which is a worldwide organization dealing with asylum issues, gives, they define a refugee as someone who is seeking a better life for economic conditions. So yeah, it can be as wide as you like it. The 51 Convention is really restrictive in its interpretation.
Luisa Gautopalucci from Studenti Democristiani Maltin. I have three questions.
Okay.
Last month, if I'm not incorrect, there was a statistics on the Wall Street Journal that said that even in certain countries where you would, like for example the UK, where you would expect that there is tolerance towards refugees and illegal immigration, has been proved by an international organ that there is still this intolerance towards refugees and immigration. Also, second question is, the statement, actually. As International Secretary of the Student Organization, I get to attend a lot of international conferences, and I've just been to a conference in Stockholm organized by a think tank, which is called Timbro. And they cannot understand the situation in Malta, and that they think that even in other countries like Norway and Finland, that you should let illegal immigration, you should let immigrants come and join your country. If they find work, we need them, we have the resources, they can join our workforce, it's good for us. Don't you think that Malta is in a disadvantage in this situation due to the fact that we don't have sufficient resources, not even on a national level, imagine for these immigrants, etc.? I'm being a bit the devil's advocate here.
Don't worry, Louise.
Third question is, also, we've spoken about initiatives so for repatriation, which are offered by certain countries. Once again, does Malta have the resources to offer such initiatives? Because we're speaking about big amounts of money here. And don't you think that on a national level, that could cause more intolerance and more conflict? Because I mean, you can't have a Maltese person who is not getting his social benefits, but then you might be offering these social benefits to a person who's not Maltese. Personally, I think that can cause conflict.
Okay, thanks. Okay, let's start with the first one, and the UK and the tolerance issue. It's funny you should say that, because I've just read an article saying that out of every four English people, only one person is anti-asylum seeker. So I'm surprised.
Yeah, it was a good surprise for me too, because even certain countries like Finland and Norway, where you would generally expect, I mean, it was also based mostly on an anti-Muslim feeling. And I'm afraid in Malta we have this feeling too, so...
But not all asylum seekers are Muslim.
No, it's true, but it's... For example, in Malta we have the mentality, which is not correct, because like you're saying, most people come from Somalia. Like, we have this mentality that most asylum seekers come from are Muslim, and I think that's something we have to...
I mean, it would really make absolutely no difference, because if they're asylum seekers, they're asylum seekers and they're in need of protection. So but if you're Muslim, if you're Buddhist, if you're... It makes absolutely no difference at all, or it should make no difference.
Do you think there's more intolerance towards maybe Muslim asylum seekers?
I don't think we know enough about the intolerance issue at the moment. I think that there's a lot of ideas floating around, and a lot of perceptions on us being racist, intolerant, xenophobic. Okay, I can imagine what you're going to say. But at the moment, we don't really know. Last year, the EU started to fund a study here in Malta. There's a body monitoring xenophobia and racism, and they're gathering statistics and information. I feel very uncomfortable when people talk about things with no solid backing. Okay, my perception as a citizen is also that some people can be terribly racist. But on the other hand, I know loads of people who aren't. So we need to find out. That's one thing. Regarding the insufficient resources and workload in Malta, I'm sure you know that, for example, in the construction industry, Malta actually wants people to come here and work. There is actually a free market for people to come from third countries to work here, because we don't have enough people to carry out the work on construction sites. So this is a niche which a lot of asylum seekers do. I mean, I know one lawyer who at the moment is working on a construction site. It's one of the only places he could find a job. He's never worked on a construction site before in his life, but this is the work he has found. So I think that it's a misconception that in all areas asylum seekers are taking work from Maltese people. I don't think that's true. I think that people who have an interest to say that may be saying it. Again, though, that's my perception. Regarding the cost of repatriation, it's an interesting issue. It will cost money, but I think we need to see how much money it's costing us now. It costs us a lot of money to keep people in detention, you know. I don't have the figures here. I usually do carry them around with me. It costs us a lot of money every day. I'm sure it's much more than that, actually. When you're talking about shifts, it costs a lot of money to keep a person in detention. We're talking about 18 months worth of detention. That's one thing. Then, what it does to the system when that person leaves detention. Because, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. They have no work permit, but they work. These people have to work. If they don't work, they're not going to get any money to live. An asylum seeker who is accepted for the first 2 months gets government support. For 2 months. And the support we're talking about is £2.50 a day. If he has a family. So, if you...
an asylum seeker?
No, this is an accepted.
Accepted.
So... If you don't even have that coming in, I mean, the first thing that most people who are accepted do as soon as they come out of detention and get their cheque, which is £9, okay, for the first 2 weeks, they get their cheque, they will buy a telecard, surprise, surprise, to phone home, and then start thinking about how they're going to survive. So people who don't even have that have an even huger problem. They have to find work. And there are people out there who are willing to employ them. So I think you're right in saying it's going to cost money, but I think we need to balance out how much it is really costing at the moment if we don't do it. Plus the fact that this is a short-term solution, isn't it? Whereas the repatriation issue would be long-term.
Question, but I'm under the impression that when a rejected asylum seeker, after spending the 18 months in detention, after spending 6 months in Malta, can, under the Immigration Act, apply for the ID card. And I know people have been given this ID card, and in my mind, there's no logic behind it. For 2 years, which can be withdrawn at any time, is temporary, it's for use only in Malta, etc. But like people from Liberia have been out, paused the 6 months, applied for this ID card and got it.
But Daniela, are you talking about...
people who've got the two rejects.
But if you've got the two rejects and you've... you mean you've got two rejections within the 6 month period?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would have been...
two rejections during the 18-month period.
Ah, during the 18-month, because that's a bit... Well, why should you have been given an ID card after 6 months if you're still in detention?
Well, when they're out of detention...
after the 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have an ID which gives you freedom of movement. And what that's doing is protecting you from being picked up by the police. But it doesn't give you the right to do anything else. It's one of those threefold. For those of you who haven't seen one, it's an identity card that folds into three like this, and you get place for stamps to come on it. It's not an ID like ours. And that's just to protect them from... because if a policeman stops them in the street, they have no identity papers whatsoever on them. That's a means of identifying who they are.
Solely. It's not a residence permit.
As a matter of fact, if they go to a polyclinic using that, the doctor won't see them. You have to make arrangements somehow for the doctor to see them and not to charge them, because they're foreigners. So they're supposed to be charged what a foreigner would pay for medical treatment. If you apply for asylum and you have, say you come in legally, people who come in by air on a valid passport and apply for asylum, we never talk about those, but they come in legally. They're not put into detention because they had their documentation. If you apply for asylum, you're not entitled to send your children to school or anything like that. I mean, I know someone, for example, who has two children, and is paying, don't ask me how she's managing it, but she's paying as a foreigner to send her children to local school. That's what the ID card's for, Daniela. They're keeping you going.
Hanin, I would like to ask you about the legal evaluation of the period of detention and the conditions of detentions under the European Convention of Human Rights, under the European Convention on the Prevention of Torture, and under the basic standards for the treatment of prisoners, and the position of the committee for the prevention of torture.
I'd need another hour, at least. the detention issue has been talked about to death over the past few weeks. Thank goodness, it's now out in the open, and I think most people who used to visit detention centres before used to wonder why no one did anything about it, because you kept going there and seeing how terrible the conditions were, and no one seemed to pay any attention to the fact. Now finally someone's woken up to it. Conditions in France, for example, are said to be really bad. For the month that people are kept in detention, there have been complaints that the lights are not put off, that they're subjected to head counts at all times of the day and night, that food is substandard, that it's cold. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Having said that, I mean, I think a lot of... if you have an idea of using detention as a deterrent, or if you have a notion of using deterrent as a penalty because you've done something criminal, something wrong, then this is going to be your viewpoint on detention. I don't know how many of you have been to Halfar Detention Center. It's not called a detention center, it's called a reception center. Halfar Reception Center. And I've had words on more than one occasion about the title. I mean, there's this nice sign outside that says reception center. And they should be reception centers. And there are basic minimum standards issued by UNHCR regarding basic minimum standards for reception centres, because the notion of detention shouldn't come into it. So if you want detention centre standards, it's a bit of a paradox, because we shouldn't be talking about detention at all. If you have entered a country irregularly but not illegally, you should not be detained. If you've committed a crime, you should be detained. And even if you've committed a crime, you are still entitled to basic minimum standards. And if you remember the Gil Robles report, he said that the prisons were in pretty good shape. Here in Malta, I mean, big investment, millions went into Corradino Correctional Facility, and the conditions are not fantastic, but they're okay. And I have met asylum seekers who have been rejected on more than one occasions. I mentioned them tonight. I won't tell you what country they're from. Who spent a while in Corradino Correctional Facility, and I went and saw them there. And they said that they're much happier to be in prison. Much happier. Just like there were a number of people who were much happier to be at Mount Carmel, because the conditions were better. But I can't really talk to you about minimum conditions for detention, because we shouldn't be talking about detention for asylum seekers. No, but however, for
the Committee on the Prevention of Torture, if we are talking about administrative detention, or some people who are put under administrative control, they are considered also to be treated in the same way as the prisoners are treated.
Well, then, at least the minimum standards for people who are detained for having committed a criminal offence. That would be the basic minimum. And if you compare the conditions in Safi to the conditions in Corradino, well, they're miles apart from each other. I mean, I don't know how many of you have thought of Safi today while it's been raining and hailing, and I think finally a lot of people are realising, you know, sort of, just imagine all these people under canvas, in the mud, in this weather. They're not like that in Corradino. They have... I'm not making going to prison out to be a picnic in any way. It must be terrible not to have your freedom. But at least you do have a roof over your head, and you do have solid walls, and there's a structure there to protect you. And you do have some space. You're not crowded into hundreds of other people. And you do have access, decent access, to a toilet and to a shower. So yeah, there should be basic minimum standards for anyone in detention.
Any cases in the European Court of Human Rights about this situation?
About minimum standards of detention of asylum seekers?
And the period of
detention. Yes, of course
detention.
There are. Yeah. Regarding periods of... regarding detention itself, per se, there have been many cases in England, for example.
About Malta?
No. No. There's one case still pending regarding a gentleman who... who had been in detention for a long period of time, and an application because it was considered an unreasonable period of time, and he was released. And because of a procedural technicality, I can see the guy in front of me, the poor man had to go back into detention. He went in and out, he was in Halfar, not in Safi, but he went in and out of detention about three times in the space of a week. He's now out, but that's not the point. The point is that he stayed there longer than he should have done. And there is a case still going on before the Constitutional Court now regarding the legality of detention itself. But it'll take its time. I mean, in every country in the world, legal proceedings take their time.
From what you have said, the problems of asylum seekers do not end with the end of detention. In fact, they start being perhaps even worse once a person is released from detention and has no means of supporting himself. He is perhaps in a worse condition than when he was detained, because when he was detained, at least he had somewhere to live or to eat, whatever. So, I mean, if we were to eliminate detention, we would not be eliminating the problem of asylum seekers. If they have no means of supporting themselves, what do? You leave them in the streets. So we have to provide anyway somewhere for them to stay. And there is, I mean, I think there are various aspects to the whole issue. There's a human and the personal aspect. When you meet the asylum seekers face to face and you say that they are people, you know, like us. But there's also a statistical aspect, which is especially of concern to politicians, because politicians are always quoting numbers in their speeches. Number of unemployed, number of new industries, and so on. So they quote numbers as well, and some people are worried by the numbers, not by the people themselves. I mean, for example, but it's a question of numbers. And there's also a geopolitical aspect, I think, because when you have a country like Somalia, for example, in Europe. We seem to be happy to allow Somalia to remain in chaos as long as we give refugee status to those few, relatively very few people who manage to reach our shores. While there are millions who are still suffering and would be potential refugees. So I think that countries also have a duty not just to... I mean, this is probably out of the topic of today, but I feel that countries, Western countries, have a duty not just to give refugee status to those who manage to reach our shores, but also to concern themselves with the safety of those who remain in Somalia, for example, no? Which is not really done, because that's too big of a problem, probably. But in any case, I mean, if we were to eliminate detention, because that was my first point, we would still have to find a solution or somewhere where to keep the asylum seekers. And I think that if asylum seekers in Malta were to be allowed to go wherever they want, the problem for Malta would be that most of them would leave, because they don't want to stay here anyway, and Malta would be accused, because most of them go to Italy probably, so Italy would accuse us of allowing illegal immigration ourselves, no? I think that is one of the problems of our government, that we don't want to be accused by other European countries of allowing illegal immigration, like Libya is accused, for example. But Libya doesn't care because they don't need Europe, so while we are members of the European Union.
And Libya is not a signatory to the 51 exactly. Convention anyway.
So I think one of the reasons for detention is to avoid asylum seekers from leaving Malta on their way to Italy, because that's what they where they would go.
Okay, you've raised so many interesting points. I don't know which one to start with. They're all really, really good. Regarding funding countries to become self-sufficient so that people won't want to leave, is the obvious answer. I mean, we should be investing in helping countries that have problems to put their house in order, to give what we have, some of what we have, to help them at source. Because as you very rightly said, the people who get here are the strong people with some money. The really, really, really poor people can't leave. They're stuck there. So we should be helping. And from a justice perspective, certainly, that's what we should be investing in. But obviously, it's easier to talk about it than to do it. But that's one issue. Regarding the detention, justifying detention the way you've done, I have a little problem with that. People who have some sort of status, either THP or refugee status, qualify for a travel document. Under the 51 Convention, it's like a passport, but it's not a passport. It's called a travel document, and your nationality is listed on it, and it says very specifically under what grounds it's being given to you. But it permits you to travel, which means that if you want to go to Italy, you're not doing it illegally.
Those are refugees.
No, the people with temporary humanitarian protection as well.
They have their status, not the rejected as I
No, mentioned. Not the rejected ones, definitely not the rejected. The rejected people are stuck here, as we said. But all those people can travel. It doesn't mean that they can stay there, though, even though they try to. Because of the Dublin Convention, the person who's responsible for you is the first place you sought asylum. So if you just happen to come to Malta and seek asylum, Malta's responsible for you. Yeah, well, that's one way of looking at it. If it were just us being responsible, we're talking about 1,000 people a year. We're not talking about the huge numbers people keep inflating it to. And I think that you tend to see asylum seekers or refugees or TPRs in a group. One, because for many of them, their skin color is different to ours, so they tend to stand out in a crowd. I mean, like when I've been to a country where most people are dark-skinned, I stand out because I'm a different color. But that's why they stand out, and because they happen to be concentrated in particular areas. Because Halfar and Lister barracks have such a big concentration, that means that on the Birzebuja route, if you get on a bus, most people are going to be asylum seekers. Balzan, which has a huge center now, is going to have all the kids, for example, all the children from the families there, go to school in Balzan and are doing very well, let me tell you. But the big concentration there. If you go to, I don't know, to Mostar, you probably wouldn't find a single person. A new center... very big center, huge center, I think it's probably too big, is going to open in Marsa. So again, we're going to have a huge concentration. There's no ideas of integration. There are small pockets, for example, small flats in St. Paul's Bay, in Guardamangia, where people can actually fit in. But if you're talking about 200, 300 people in one place, they're going to stick out like a sore thumb. Now, it would be possible for them to be received, not detained, received, and screened and assessed in a short period of time, and then left to find their own way. So if you give them the right to a job, they're going to be able to find a job. Most of the people, I think, yet to meet a lazy asylum seeker. As a whole, they are remarkably hard-working people. They really want to find work. They want to send money home. So they want to find as much work as they can. So I don't think there would be a problem about them sustaining themselves. As to 1,000 people, it isn't the whole 1,000 who would be working, because a number of those are children, and a number of those are women who don't go out to work, culturally. So we're talking about a proportion of people who could integrate into the labour market. The unions in the conference were very happy to have people who could get work permits join the union itself, to give them rights as workers, so there wouldn't be exploitation, so that they would have rights to social benefits, the whole works. I like to think it could work.
Just a comment.
Sure.
Because, as you said, unions would accept them working. But I don't see unions talking to their Maltese members in favor of asylum seekers.
Well, they did this openly at the immigration conference.
At the conference,
you know?
But if you read the papers, yeah. You know, the union papers even, there isn't really a lot of sympathy for asylum seekers. But in the conference?
No. Michael Parnis wrote several articles.
And so did the deputy general secretary.
Of General Workers Union. Uh-huh. So there are
not last Sunday, the Sunday before that.
And even like 6-8 months ago.
I mean, the exploitation issue has now reached a level where I think everyone's disgusted by it. When it was in the papers, I don't know if you remember, but there was a young man who came into my office and said, I tried to get paid and they beat me up. And I thought, well, you know, okay, they've beaten him up. What did they do to you? And he bent down and showed me his head. And there were all these 14 stitches in his head. And I said, I just couldn't believe it. He had asked for 5 weeks' wages and was hit by, what do they call them? These industrial scissors, you know, these big metal scissors?
Shears.
That's it. He'd been hit over the head with one of those. And that's just one story. There are loads of others. There are some very nice people out there who don't exploit, who really respect people who are trying to make a go of it and try to do a decent day's work. But there are always a few nasty people there. And then there are the people who get hurt on the job without a work permit. I mean, I know personally one man who lost an index finger, one man who's had a hand crushed, and another young man who's lost a leg right from the top of his thigh, 24-year-old, with no leg, working without a work permit. And what I'm worried about at the moment is not only what compensation he's going to get, but what medical bill he's going to get from the government, because he shouldn't be getting medical services for free. And we're talking huge, thousands and thousands of pounds. The prosthesis alone is going to come to over 3,000. They need to work regularly, and that way they'll be contributing to society as well.
We have room for just one final question, because Ruth said she wants to leave by 8 o'clock.
Muafak Tutunji from Dart al Islam. In the recent days, there were some incidents, and there might arise cases where who are in custody might have criminal case. How does that affect their application, knowing that the legal backing they might have or not have there?
A criminal case here in Malta or in their original country?
No,
here in Malta.
While in custody, yeah. And while they have applied, they okay. Have their application.
Yes, there are a number of those cases, you're right.
You mentioned some who were
in prison. Yes. It doesn't affect their asylum application in any way. It's a separate issue. Obviously, if they've committed a crime, they have to answer for it, just like any other citizen would. So they might have to go to prison instead of detention. sorry. I, control myself. No, it isn't funny because it's some of the crimes that are committed. I'm not trying to justify them because violence is always wrong. But some of the things that happen because of overcrowding. Tempers run high, people become very territorial. It's amazing what people end up fighting over. And probably if I were sharing a tent with another 20 people, I would also become very territorial. But yes, if you commit a crime, you must answer for it before the courts. And if there's a punishment, you get the punishment the same as any other citizen would. But it has no bearing on your asylum application.
So the period, which is the 18 months, or how does that come into place?
Well, the 18-month period is supposed to be there as a maximum period within which the asylum process is carried out. So presumably, but this is just me presuming, if I were to spend 6 months of that 18 months in prison, it could still be the time during which the asylum process is being carried out. Why should it be 2 years maximum? That wouldn't be fair at all, would it?
I want to thank Ruth very much for fielding such a wide variety of questions so informatively, as well as for an excellent talk. I'm always struck when you listen closely to lawyers that they make very good anthropologists, perhaps better anthropologists than anthropologists. Thank you very much, Ruth. You are all invited to next week's symposium, Refugees and Immigrants, The View from Anthropology. Thank you very much.